Hello, we're just testing this.
Can you hear my microphone as well?
I can hear your microphone.
Okay.
And I can hear mine.
All right, let's check.
You Can't Say That is a sociology podcast that poses more questions than answers. Join your hosts, Drs. Nama Carwin and Melanie White, in a journey to make the familiar unfamiliar.
Hello and welcome to You Can't Say That, a sociological podcast that raises more questions than answers. It raises more questions than raising answers, but we give answers, not raise them.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
You found a flaw already.
I know. Well, here we are.
Last week you said poses more questions than answers.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Can you pose an answer though?
No.
Anyway, I guess we'll find out.
Oh my gosh. We have to change the name. It's all over. It's done. Podcast over. Let's go home.
I'm not even sure if I introduced myself. Apparently my name is Melanie White, a.k.a. Fault Finder.
And I'm Nama Carlin, the one who puts the faults in things.
No. Faults are what give creativity to life. There we are.
I love the fact that for today's episode, you have immediately found error or some sort of conceptual problem in our intro, something that we have not identified in the 5 weeks that we've been doing this. Because this week we're talking about Freud, someone who was very good at finding curious interpretations for the human condition. And I feel that what you have just done now is a little bit Freudian, but we can discuss that later.
Oh, I was just thinking, I wonder if Nama feels guilty. And if she does feel guilty.
Yes, I feel guilty for giving us the wrong name. This is our podcast.
Nama, you can't say that.
I carry so much
you
responsibility.
Can't.
I can't?
That's no, you
true.
Can't.
Oh, I love that you've put that in there. That was a great joke.
As Nama says, today we're going to be discussing Freud, and Freud is often considered to be...
Controversial.
Controversial, sure. But also, you know, I think one of the problems with Freud is that he's so infused popular culture that it's hard to find a real dyed-in-the-wool Freudian, in the sense that we have all of these words like, or phrases like Freudian slips, or ooh, that was pretty Freudian, wasn't it?
In that exact voice.
Yes, the voice is crucial. And so bearing that in mind, I think it's sometimes difficult for people to actually take him seriously, and yet he gave so much to our understanding of what the self is and how we can access the unconscious dimensions of our personality structures. He's absolutely amazing.
I feel like whenever we come to Freud, inappropriate.
Nama is already into the libidinal impulses.
When we come to Freud, it's already by way of downplaying his work or finding flaws in his work. So there's quite a large tradition now in psychology that resists Freud and tries to debunk his claims. But as you've said, his way of thinking has been very fundamental to how we see the world, whether we agree or disagree. I mean, you're right. It is very difficult to find a true Freudian these days, unless you watch Frasier, because, oh my gosh, far out. That is wonderful. They're so Freudian.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I remember recently asking my students if there was anyone of them who didn't think they had an unconscious, and no one put up their hand. And the implication was that they have all assumed one of the great Freudian insights, that we have an unconscious dimension of self, and that there is some kind of unconscious motivations or impulses that come to direct our action or our beliefs. And so that, I think, for our listeners, if anyone is listening, if anyone is wondering, you know, should I take this Freudian discussion seriously? I guess the big question is, do you believe that you have have an unconscious. And if you do have an unconscious, and you believe that you do, then that is testament, I think, to Freud's reach and the way that he has penetrated the intellectual and popular consensus about what makes up selfhood.
I think it's interesting to point out the discussion of subconscious or unconscious, because for Descartes, who we started with, there was only the conscious being. Mm. So it's a nice contrast. And with Durkheim, who we had last week, for Durkheim, the self was, you know, the conscious, but it was the social self, the social being. So we're getting into different dimensions here of understanding how the self is conceptualized.
Mm. Well, just thinking back to Descartes, the idea that, you know, part of his objective was to discover the foundation for knowledge, and insofar as dreaming was something that lent itself to the senses, that was discounted as the ground for knowledge. And
here comes Freud,
who's like, hello, actually, for all of those ailments and symptoms and illnesses for which we actually suffer from, but yet can find no organic or embodied cause, there's a reason. And the reason has to do with this very complex relationship between different dimensions of the personality structure. So those that are hidden from view and those that actually come into view, and the various tensions between them.
What I want to do before we get into everything that you've just said right now is give our listeners a brief biography of Freud and who he was, because we're all about the theorist gossip. And I don't know that Freud has very interesting gossip. Does he? I'm sure he does. I'm not aware of it. Maybe you are. But just by way of kind of framing who Freud was and when he wrote, he died in 1939. He left Austria to escape the Nazis. Unfortunately, Freud's books, as a Jewish psychoanalyst, Freud's books were targeted and destroyed by the Nazis. So his very existence and work was threatened in the rise of Nazi Germany. He was very focused on this idea of the psyche, of our mind. He wanted to explore. And the same way that Durkheim wanted to create a science of society, for Freud, it was a science of our psyche and mind, ourselves, our thought. When you said, you know, we're all aware of Freudian slips, right away my mind went to, there's a shop that sells Freudian slippers.
Oh, is that right?
I know. I've always wanted a pair. So
I was thinking about a Freudian slip, like, you know, a slip that you wear under a dress.
But, oh, I like yours better. I guess I'm going to just like name drop the company that does make the Freudian slippers, because I think they're great. It's the Unemployed Philosophers Guild. If anyone wants to buy me Freudian slippers, I'm a size 7. So yeah, just throwing that out there.
I would like the slip.
So Freud presents us with this systematic theory of the mind and its relation to the unconscious. Really interesting part. Did anyone before Freud really have a conceptualization of the unconscious? So for Descartes, it was absolutely the conscious being, and the dreaming mind was the catalyst for proving or for arguing that scholasticism as a method, as a philosophical method, is flawed. Then we have Durkheim, who isn't about the unconscious or subconscious. He's all about we are social beings and have to participate consciously or you know, through various forms of coercion in social norms. Is Freud really the first to conceptualize the unconscious as we know it?
Well, I think it's important to remember that Freud was part of a whole group of different psychologists and intellectuals in Vienna. One is Charcot, as I remember, and they ended up developing a kind of a salon where they would share stories, share different sorts of diagnoses and discussions.
Sounds pretty unethical. That wouldn't pass. Yeah, no, there were no medical ethics in like the 1920s.
No, it would seem not. And well, and I think, yeah, so I mean, absolutely, I think that that's true. I mean, there's this certain sense of intrigue and interest in the heyday, but of course, without any kind of ethical restrictions or what have you. And certainly, I mean, it's a testament to seeing Freud's notebooks and field notes on his various patients.
One thing that I want to take from this discussion to lead us to our conversation is this idea that Durkheim had, we discussed last week, where there is a tension between your individual desires and social expectations, and that is a continuous tension, and it's a productive tension, and it's part of who we are. For Freud, there is a similar relationship between the individual's desires and society's expectations. But for Freud, this tension isn't necessarily productive.
I mean, he most clearly talks about that tension, I think, in Civilization and Its Discontents. And interestingly, it was written in 1930, and Freud was suffering from a very debilitating cancer of the jaw. Whenever you look at any of the photos or images, you'll see him with a pipe, and that the cancer was incredibly painful. And it's perhaps for that reason, when you read the Civilization and Its Discontents, you see this, or you feel this sense of despair. And it's also, I think, a sense of despair looking at
politics
and certainly what's happening in Europe at the time, and the rise of fascism both in Germany and in Italy, and a transformative kind of culture taking place that gives rise to certain questions about, you know, is this the future of humanity? Is this ultimately where we're going? How do we resolve the fact that we as human beings are so inherently destructive and aggressive? And is it possible to find a way of overcoming this?
He wants to understand the nature of the human psychic life in all its complexity, this contradiction between, you know, we are so violent and aggressive, yet there are parts of us that are kind, generous, caring, loving. How do we reconcile these differences? He's writing, I guess, at a time where there are various established disciplines, which we've mentioned before. So we've had Durkheim, representative of the sociologist, which overstates social dimensions of the self. He has philosophy, which we discussed when we looked at Descartes, and that tends to overstate the conscious being. And then we have psychology for Freud is unable to treat neuroses or pathologies, so the things that happen in your body, that manifest in your body physically. This is where we find Freud.
A first starting point is the acknowledgement that conscious awareness doesn't give us a full insight into the totality of the human psyche, that it's much more complex. Insofar as it is complex, there are conscious motivations and unconscious motivations that inform and shape our general conduct. And we simply can't get a full and complete understanding of why it is we do the things we do by just focusing on the conscious manifestations of our conduct. And so the focal point then is to access the unconscious motivations. But of course, that presents a challenge because they're unconscious.
How do we access them?
Hence, how do we know what they are? And so I think your comment earlier about pathology is really important, in the sense that there are all of these physical manifestations of some kind of pathological psychic activity where a patient presumably could go to a doctor and say, you know, I'm not feeling very well. I have this nervous tic underneath my eye when I'm stressed. depressed or...
I get it. Is that why you...
No, I did. I thought I would... That was a nice little crumb, and I was just seeing if Nama would say, oh, yeah, that's me. Actually, I also have that nervous tick in my eye. It goes...
Yeah, oh my gosh, when I'm stressed, the last 6 months of my PhD, constant eye twitch.
Well, and then, you know, I think about, for me, sometimes when I get overexcited or anxious, I begin to stutter. There's all of these very fascinating physiological manifestations of unsettled mental activity. And so...
Like stomach aches? Do you get stomach aches when you're nervous? Or always before you need to give a public talk, you need to pee really badly? Or
I get the butterflies.
Do you get the butterflies? Yeah.
So all of those things, I think, are symptoms of what Freud is interested in. And of course, they only become worthy of attention from a clinical sense, I suppose, when they start interfering with what you're seeking to gain and hope for your life, if it's undermining your ability to be in the world in a reasonably happy or contented fashion. So I think with Freud, then, it's partly using psychoanalytic techniques, you know, and some of them are things like talk therapy or association to reveal the complex relation of the different elements of the psychical structure of the self.
For Freud, then, there are three structures of the self that the psychical that compile all of the above. The psychical structure of the self. We have the libido, this unconscious urge. For Freud, it is the sex drive, and it's something that manifests at birth. You have the ego. That's the second layer. This is the element of the human psyche that really facilitates the fulfillment of our basic desires and also inhibits our libidinal urges, because if we're all driven or motivated by our libidinal desires, our libidinal urges, we might not have a very functioning society. So we need to find some sort of mediation. The libidinal desires is your innermost driving force, and the ego is what mediates between that driving force and society's expectations. And then you have the superego, which is the element of the human psyche that has internalized these social norms and values. The superego is organized of our culture and the ego and the id, while the superego works in the level of society, civilization, culture. Ego and libidinal desires, or the id, are working to realize libidinal desires.
One thought occurred to me was that I think what makes Freud so challenging for so many people is that he uses these terms in different ways at different points in time. And I think this is why for some academics they find Freud so exciting to study, is because it's constantly changing, constantly dynamic. So he uses some words at some point, introduces others later on. And so these three terms are sort of just generalized categories for the general elements that he's working with, because he's constantly revising them. Do you mean the Freud of the 1910 paper, or do you mean the Freud of the 1926 discussion?
I love your accents.
Yes. Well, so it could be any of those, but so these are just general kind of orienting categories. And it made me think, you know, a simple example would perhaps help our listeners.
Okay.
I have a libidinal drive because I'm hungry. That drive is ultimately what wants me to satisfy my hunger. And my ego is the one that's going to satisfy that hunger. But my superego says, Melanie, you've made an obligation and commitment to Nama and to the listeners if you can't say that. And so you must wait until the podcast is over, graciously say farewell to everyone, and then rush your butt down and get something to nourish yourself or feed yourself. And that will be okay then. So it's that was all very strange. I don't know.
That's a very good example.
Well, so it's the superego that rationalizes or provides means by which to intervene to elongate the time that you would need to wait to realize your libidinal desires by the ego.
Sounds like there's something going on here between this need to satisfy your desire and the length of time that you have to wait in order to satisfy. What happens after you're hungry? So you've now spent 2 hours being famished and you're in a place of discomfort, potential suffering. Do you then go and eat? What is the feeling?
Oh, well, it's one of hallelujah. I have achieved the foremost pleasure. It's funny. I was just thinking about this. One thing that Freud uses as the animating principle behind these libidinal drives is he believes in this notion of a pleasure principle, that we as human beings are striving for some kind of happiness to be achieved through arriving at this pleasure principle. Nice homespun example. Recently it happened to me that I was on public transit and I needed to go to the bathroom.
Oh dear. Worse.
It was terrible. I had had too much coffee. And do you know that feeling that you get when you have so much liquid in your body that is not supposed to be there, and you feel like your glands are up in your neck, like your lymph nodes?
I've literally never had that.
Oh no, it just feels like everything is swimming.
Maybe you need to see a doctor.
Well, no. First of all, I need to get off the bus. And yet there is that very awkward, like, shuffle, cross leg trying to move to get off the bus.
Yeah.
And so thinking about this experience, I think that it's instructive for Freud, because there is this incredible pain, a physical pain, a physiological pain associated with the fact that, I might pee my pants at any possible moment, combined with an overwhelming desire to empty my bladder. And so that relationship between pleasure and pain is something that Freud says animates many of our decisions. And so the minute you shuffle, shuffle, walk, and find yourself in a bathroom, and suddenly you just are able just to suddenly release yourself and release all of that liquid from your body, the extraneous liquid, that's important, you know, you don't want all of it to go. We end up feeling this incredible, overwhelming sense of relief. And that relief is a feeling of the constraints and the tension or the pressure that was formerly animating us in this shuffle, walk to the bathroom, and this overturning of pain in our body. Somehow it's suddenly released. And for Freud, that is almost a joyous experience. That is ultimately what we live for.
That moment of easing of tension, of that decrease in pressure.
Indeed.
I can relate to that. I think that there's something, some value to it. We sometimes do things that are, when you wear really tight shoes all day, shoes that are just so painful, and you know that you can just take them off midday, but you choose not to, you persevere, and then you get home and you take them off, and it's the best feeling in the world. Or like taking off your bra when you get home, like first thing. We do these things that constrain us, that put us through all these different pains in order to then, once it's all done, all over, this increased release and a decrease in pressure and this wonderful easing of tension.
Do you know what, Nama?
That is pleasureful.
Yes, you know what I love about you?
Yeah.
Is you live large.
Putting on shoes.
You know,
I wear shoes. I live large. I wear a bra.
I wear a bra and I take it off when I get home. Whoa, and it's Friday night.
Literally the best moment of my day.
For me, it's washing my face when I get home. Yeah. And so this is, I think, that feeling of pleasure that you get when those things happen is countered by, in part, the difficulties when you are unable to
take off your shoes, take off your bra, go pee.
Exactly. And so, going pee if you can't, and if the circumstances aren't there, I've had it where I've had to go back so badly and then waiting. And then suddenly I'm sitting down on the toilet and then I can't go.
Yeah. You lose it. Where does it go?
Well, Freud has the answer for us. He says, great. Hello, Melanie and Nama. You have just repressed. You have just repressed your ostensible...
Our libidinal desires, our instincts.
Yes. And, you know, you've done that as a means, a psychical means of being able to reduce or limit the pain that you're experiencing. And so what you've in effect done is redirect that libidinal energy. So where does it go? Well, it will manifest in a really, really strange ways. It might manifest in eyes twitching, Melanie stuttering, or stumbling, because I'm a terrible klutz, as I am wont to do, or in a whole series of other kinds of physical symptoms. And of course, it was these sorts of pathological symptoms that Freud in particular was very interested in.
Definitely, as someone who experiences depression, it doesn't happen to you necessarily. There's no physical symptom, one physical symptom. There are multiple symptoms that manifest physically, but it's not located in my body in a particular way.
Do you mean that it's not located in one particular cause, like, it's a virus, or, it's a bacteria?
It's something that I can't put my finger on, exactly. It's not something I can just go get blood tests for and say, oh, look, your B12 is low, you need to go get some more B12.
Thinking about Freud and thinking about these so-called pathological cases that reflect a repression or some kind of redirection of a pleasure principle. Mm. So... It's the sense that anyone who in principle is manifesting symptoms reflects the fact that they are not being able or are not capable of or can't for some reason or other realize their pleasures. And so, you know.
But aren't we all exhibiting symptoms to various degrees? I mean, this is the curious part about Freud, I think. It seems like he's signaling out specific forms of experiencing the world or different experiences, and I find that part of Freud a bit you know curious, I guess I should say
curious is Nama's. No, I think that's the right point. I mean, part of it, though, I think, is that in Civilization and Its Discontents, I mean, I think he's getting down to realizing that we are all, to greater or lesser extent, pathological insofar as we have somehow acquired an imbalance between an inherent aggression as part of one of our libidinal drives, a death drive, in relation to a love drive. And so, you know, these two libidinal forces are competing against one another and have somehow been redirected such that we can no longer achieve a full-blown pleasure. And so there's this marvelous set of lines where he talks about the fact that we are so inured to day-to-day life, it's too challenging, too difficult. So we take, any kind of narcotic, or we take, we drink
vapors
red wine.
Yeah, exactly.
We drink red wine on a Friday night after having washed one's face, taken off those shoes, and taken off one's bra.
That is absolutely my Friday night.
I'm sorry, I indulged myself there. It was just very lovely. And so I think that for Freud, as a psychoanalyst, part of the goal then is to try to restore these symptoms and to see these symptoms as related to a definite psychical cause, which is a repression or some kind of redirection of libidinal energy, and free that energy up so that we can actually rediscover our pleasures. And from that vantage, these pathologies won't manifest themselves because they are symptoms that are without any kind of obvious cause. So
he wants to make the unconscious conscious.
Yeah.
Conscious.
Yeah, and restore symptom to cause, to figure out what is it that's manifesting this. And it's not a bacterium, it's not a virus, it's not a lack of B12 or some kind of mineral problem. It is ultimately a psychical imbalance of sorts.
How do we return symptom to cause then?
Well, I think this is the psychoanalytic method. I mean, we all have some inkling, I suppose, given how saturated Freud is in our contemporary culture. Word association, means of word association can somehow give rise to these unconscious ideas, or the analysis of dreams, that dreams give us insight into how or what our hidden desires might be.
Because we've repressed them to the point that they manifest only when we are unconscious, when we are sleeping, and we can let go. In Civilization and Discontent, he's exploring not only the individual. So for his entire writing career, Freud has focused on the individual's unconscious and conscious, what makes us a self. And in this text, he tries to take this perspective, this psychoanalytic perspective or method, onto civilization as a whole, exploring what civilization is. He's arguing that civilization increases sources of deep pain instead of happiness. And that again brings that back into our attention of the, you know, pleasure principle versus this idea of repression.
I am very conscious of the fact that our listeners are thinking to themselves, are these two just rabbiting? That's the word. Where is their textual evidence?
And I'm sure that everyone's concerned that we have textual evidence.
You know, well, I know. And so to that listener out there, there's there's this marvelous line that Freud has with respect to suffering. And he says that as wonderful as pleasure is, it is so hard to really experience in full, but unhappiness is much less difficult to experience. He says we are threatened with suffering from three directions: from our own body, which is doomed to decay and disillusion. So here, whenever I read that line, I think of Freud sitting there nursing that horrible jaw pain. Yeah. And I think it's because I grind my teeth and that I get headaches, and I can just empathize with that feeling of the dissolution of one's body.
That's absolutely another example of like the unconscious manifesting through your physical senses. Teeth grinding, it's that stress. It just comes through at night when it has nowhere else to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And he observes that, you know, we can't do without pain and anxiety as some kind of warning signal. But I suppose it's a question of how we diagnose those warning signals, you know, that we can each identify these forms of stress, these symptoms, grinding teeth, headaches, malaise. How do we overcome that sort of stress? How do we take a time out for self? And it's, I think what Freud is pointing to is that it's such a systemic facet of our culture that it's not simply or strictly an individual's burden, that there is a manifestation of the superego in which we all share that generates a certain patterned relation to these sorts of symptoms. And he says, ultimately, that the very fact of our relations with other people is that which is the most painful. We tend to, quote, regard it as a kind of a gratuitous addition, although it cannot be any less fatefully inevitable than the suffering from which comes from elsewhere. So for him, he's got a very poor sense of the capacity of other human beings to cherish or nurture us, that in fact, the greatest manifestation of suffering is in relation to other people.
That is very poetic and sad. Do we share in suffering in society?
You know, he's got this idea, and I suppose that he shares this with Durkheim, is the sense that human life in common has a strength or a force that is greater than any individual. And the power of this community is then often set up in opposition or in tension to the power of the individual. And so this replacement, and this is Freud's word, the replacement of the power of the individual by the power of the community, is ultimately for him the decisive step toward something called civilization. So our individual selves ultimately need to sacrifice some aspect or facet of our particular libidinal pleasure, our particular libidinal drive, in order to respond to the power of the community. So it's community, quote, civilization in Freud's terms, that end up requiring of us our ability to sacrifice something of our own desire to live in a community.
He says, he talks about sublimation similar to repression. Can we use them interchangeably for our purposes, or?
I think so. I mean, there's something about needing to repress your desires and what you want, and
to function as a functioning member of society.
That's right. I mean, there's all of these things about saving face, of being polite, of being gracious, or, you know, I'm using these old-fashioned terms of etiquette as a means of being able to articulate something of the concealment that needs to take place in our encounters in the world. That
sounds like all of these things are very restrictive, then, of my individual desires, my libidinal urges. So in a sense, we could say that civilization, society, restricts my freedoms to do what I want to do.
Absolutely. And I think that and the restricting of freedom is precisely because civilization demands certain sacrifices from us.
So we could think that these institutions that we devise give us freedoms when in fact they restrict them.
Yes, and I think they restrict them from the perspective that Freud's coming at, which is, how are we going to achieve happiness, and what is the purpose of our life? Insofar as we have a shared existence with other human beings, to what extent can we rely upon others, and must we rely upon others inevitably to be able to shape our experiences of pleasure, pain, and otherwise? For Freud, too, there are these sexual drives, and then there's also this aggressive drive, and that those two things can be mutually reinforcing. And in the context of human life that is shared together, the very fact is that for him, human beings aren't these gentle creatures who just simply want to be loved. Rather, they tend to be...
Man is wolf to man.
Yeah,
right? Isn't that what
exactly
he says?
Yeah, that there is this incredible aggressiveness. You know, he says something like, one's neighbor is not only a potential helper or a sexual object, but also someone who tempts them to satisfy their aggressiveness. So, you know, when one thinks about one's neighbor and the barking dog.
Oh my gosh, that darn dog.
I know.
They should get a cat.
So this is the problem, is that, you know, that the other, whomever it might be, could possibly allow one to realize one's sexual desires, etc., love, care, kinship, all the rest. But at the same time, that person could also lend one's to despair, to aggression, to pain, to torture, and so forth.
So we have this tension between this death drive, this love drive, this desire to be happy and have pleasure, and this desire to fight the other who is threatening me and protect who I am, my integrity. This seems to result in quite a significant emotion or experience, guilt. Freud is big on guilt. You know, you can tell he's Jewish, right? He's like, so guilt is really produced as this internal psychic control mechanism that serves civilization, serves society by helping us suppress our aggression, our instincts. We even feel guilty for just having the desire to do something. We haven't gone and done it, but yet we feel guilty for even having that thought of, ooh, I should not have had that thought. So it's a very functional expression, a very functional emotion, and an expression of society in a way to coerce us to behave in specific ways.
And I think, too, I mean, one of the qualities of civilization, insofar as it reflects the superego and the power of shared social norms and behaviors, that the superego then will make certain demands or sacrifices that we need to forego our instincts, to forego our instinct to pee when we need to pee, to have sex when we want to have sex, to destroy.
I've forgone that instinct a long time ago.
To destroy what we need to destroy. And so one of the qualities of civilization is that it redirects those sorts of instincts into a guilt, as you said, for having those instincts in the first instance. And so this is what makes civilization so powerful, is because it ends up redirecting one's own kind of agential force.
I think that we have had such a broad, like, informative episode today. And just before we wrap up, I want to give Freud the final word, because in the final part of Civilization and Its Discontents, he concludes it in such a poignant, reflective manner that we need to think of in context of, you know, that cancer growing in his jaw, the rise of fascism. So let's have that historical image in mind. And he says, "The fateful question for the human species seems to me to be whether and to what extent their cultural development will succeed in mastering the disturbance of their communal life by the human instinct of aggression and self-destruction. It may be that in this respect, precisely, the present time deserves a special interest." And this is the present time of rise of fascism. "Men have gained control over the forces of nature to such an extent that with their help, they would have no difficulty in exterminating one another to the last man." Oh, I know. Heart on hand. Those are some powerful words to read.
Or hand on heart.
Heart on hand, hand on heart. That's the one. Remove your heart. And that's what that reading that felt like, especially when we think of the place where we are today in our political world. I think that this is a very relevant point to end on. So despite the fact that we have this sad, maybe, note to end on, we can, you know, farewell Freud.
Yes.
And promise to have a more positive discussion next time.
Well, it occurs to me that one of the qualities of our podcast, you can't say that, is that we raise more questions than answers.
Yeah.
And this is Freud's fateful question that he has raised. And so...
And which we're still answering.
Exactly.
Unfortunately.
Yep. And so I think we need to wait until next time for us to consider another question and another answer.
You're on. Let's do it.
Excellent.
Thank you all for listening.
Thanks for listening. I'm Melanie White.
And I'm Carlin, and we will see you next time.
And you can't say that.
Yeah, you need to. You have the mouse.
Oops.
You Can't Say That is a Carlin White collaboration. Stephen Hunt composed our music. Francesca Rimicheng designed our logo. Cristio Fuentes makes the wheel on the bus go round and round. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.